Welcome to Inside Learning episode 115 for the 5th of June 2013. Let's dance! Stephen Rogers, live from Nottingham in Rogers Towers, coming to you with the miracle of Skype and the doyen. You can't be a doyen, can you, with your gender of doyen. Inside yeah. Learning. You can't be the doy either. Our language is so strange.
So, how's my fellow educational alley cat?
Oh, yeah, that was fun this week, wasn't it? Yeah, I'm working on becoming sloshed. excuse my ignorance, does that play south of the border? We had a chat this week on Skype, didn't we, after last week's podcast, when when Anne Glennie had a go at us over our brain gym bashing session from last week, and on Twitter there was a little bit of a chat, wasn't there, around the soundtracks that people were using for brain gym in their classroom. And that brought up this idea of the slosh and the alley cat, and it only occurred to me right now. You know, is that a dance that plays down south as well?
No.
So that may not have meant anything to you, right? No.
just what happens after a few glasses of wine.
Yeah. Well, that, yeah, as in being sloshed.
Yeah.
Well, no, maybe you didn't know then. Up here in the kind of, I'm certain about the Glasgow and kind of West of Scotland area, I don't know how much wider it plays, but certain tunes come on at social functions, usually with a kind of a line dancing beat, you know, those kind of things. Very much show me the way to Amarillo kind of beat, you know. And at that point, suddenly every woman in the room, you know, will abandon handbags. And there's a certain walk they do for the slosh. They clap the hand and they do a shoulder slinging walk. You know, they actually start doing the dance moves as they actually get onto the floor to start doing it. And then they all do this sort of in unison step. I can tell you, I've never partaken. Some men do it as well. It's not exclusively for women, but it's 90%. So
it's not a Peter K. Dad dance then.
No. Well, although, as I say, a few of them would probably partake as well. So that was the reference, yeah. I think it was actually about these dance moves in the slosh and the alley cat, which are both similar dances.
Yeah, the alley cat, yeah, no.
So you do know that one?
Well, the alley cat, yeah. But I was thinking of, I was thinking more Top Cat, you know, Phil Silvers and Benny, his sidekick.
Yeah, that was another great conversation that we had today.
You're sort of climbing out of the dustbin with scraps of educational news, you know, sort of trying to worm their way through life.
That was great news, though, for me today. Are you telling me that Phil Silvers did Top Cat? I had no idea.
Did the original, yeah. Oh.
And listeners will need to get back to us and let us know, was it in black and white or not?
Well, on the telly I watched it on, it was in black and white. So it's always a black and white dream for me.
Oh dear. Anyway, lightning appears to have struck again tonight, and we have no guest. Those of you who just quietly have not mentioned and pretended it wasn't supposed to happen, we did write it on the website that we were going to be joined tonight by Russell Tarr. Unfortunately, something's gone wrong there, and Russell, who I believe hails from Toulouse in France, we can't seem to raise him, so. C'est la vie. Yeah, again, we'll have to try and get him at some other time. It's a shame because we did have rather a lot to lose.
Yeah.
In terms of his interesting work on history and sharing teaching ideas. Seems to be an interesting guy.
That was a low trek pun, that one, Matthew.
Yes, it was indeed. Sorry about that. I do love his art.
Yeah,
it's really, really lovely, isn't it? Did he do the black cats that are always associated with Paris?
Probably he did the absinthe adverts, didn't he? Because they used to adorn student walls, I seem to remember.
Hmm.
You know, the posters.
Fantastic. So anyway, we shall press on with the most interesting articles from this week's news and see if we can bring a short and snappy podcast in tonight.
Yep, okie dokie.
you can always picture our listeners, can't you? Slap their thighs and finally a joke on the podcast. Yeah, like you've ever managed that before.
Yep.
You want to kick us off then with whatever your eagle eye has spotted?
Okay, yeah, there's one on free schools.
Oh.
And
I haven't had a free school story for a while.
No, but you know this is a bugbear of mine. Have you got your glass of wine handy?
I do.
For the glug, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, our dear Mr. Gove and I on, if they're re-elected in 2015, I think he'd dearly love to insert into the manifesto that private companies should be allowed to run schools for profit. Mm-hmm. And I think he sees the free schools as the sort of the door opener to this. And he, you know, cites Sweden, as do kind of members of a Bright Blue, a sort of modernizing conservative pressure group, sort of urged market forces to be introduced to schools, the school system, and cited the Swedish experience. Well, lo and behold, an education firm, one of the largest free school operators in Sweden, is to shut down.
Oh.
It was bought out, JB Education, I think. Three schools run by JB Education in Sweden to close, and another 19 are to be sold because this private equity group, Axel, who was the parent company, bought them in 2008 and decided too many losses were being recorded. So they're just recorded, so they're just going to go. So there you go. That's what market forces does for you. If you can't bring in a profit for your shareholders, then, you know, stuff the education. That's money's the bottom line.
Yeah, particularly interesting. I suppose... we're always guilty of cherry picking the data that supports our case. Is there a wider analysis? Is obviously one Swedish school, but or am I misunderstanding? Is this like a whole Swedish, you know, sort of chain of schools?
Yeah, well, this is a chain of schools. So there's three been closed down, and 19 are to be sold off. I don't know what's going to happen to the young people in them, or to the teachers. But, you know, but there's also, there's casualties in the United States as well, where these kind of schools that are allowed to make profits, I mean, there's examples of them being closed down.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Do we know that Gove is really pushing for that, or is it just that he wants it to be part of his thousand flowers that bloom?
He did say somewhere that he's in the business of putting out ideas and then... listening to the feedback and accepting the strongest criticisms. But I mean, he is on record of saying that he saw absolutely no reason why schools shouldn't, you know, these chains shouldn't be allowed to make money, and it would encourage more more innovation in the system, more drive in the system, and certainly there is quite a strong conservative pressure group apparently who's urging market forces to be kind of fully opened. You know, the academies and the free schools are the first, if you like, the kind of wedge in the door.
Well, I guess he would dearly love to be seen as a prophet.
Yeah.
So prophet's perhaps the means for him to do so. I can hear the voice of Graham Lester from a few episodes back. He was quite clear, wasn't he, that you know, solving the problem of dealing with innovation and complexity in schools was probably not best done with the market. Although, you know, the market is good at dealing with complexity in general, but not in schooling. Now that I'm saying it, for the life of me, I can't remember what the reason was he gave. Do you recall?
No. But I mean, yeah, there are elements in life where obviously markets, you know, work to your benefit. I mean, if I want a pair of trainers, then I suppose the market in that. You go out and get a pair of shoes, you know, helps me. But there's areas
when we come to the stage, mind you, with that, when there are big moral questions, I'd have to acknowledge, you know, that nowadays you don't even pay for your trainers, do you? You know, you have a third world child coming over and buffing them up for you and giving you a couple of dollars to take them off his hands.
That's right, because the market is no respecter of values and ethics, really. I mean, just look at the argument over the tax liabilities. Yeah. I mean, there's always casualties with markets because those who've got power to corral the market and buy it out will always end up on top. You know, that's why at the end of the day, the we get sort of big conglomerations, you know, and the private equity firms who've obviously got huge amounts of money and can move that money around really quickly. And if they decide that the lie of the land is not so good, then they can pull out at an instant, and they've got, you know, there's nobody but you know, they don't have a loyalty to anything but their shareholders. So I don't think the market has any place in a system which has more public civic values at heart.
And yet we do use it in places, don't we? You know, we use it to support some of our buildings in Scotland. I don't know about down south. We've got some.
Well, yeah, but it's been used again.
Private financing.
Yeah, but that costs the taxpayers millions. You know, again, I've forgotten the figures, but the figures are mind-watering because what's happening with some of these contracts? The civil service have negotiated really bad contracts. They've been, you know, the sort of private companies who've been involved in this public finance initiative, private public finance initiative, have really screwed the taxpayer. And then what happens is you find that they're then bought out, they're then sold on at a further loss to the taxpayer because the government sometimes has to come and bail them out. It's actually not saved the taxpayer money at all. In fact, it's cost a great deal.
You got a phone ringing there, Steve?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Almost never happens.
Yeah, I know.
Can't the maid deal with it?
Sorry?
Can't the maid get it?
Careful what you say there.
Well, you don't have an extensive staff there in Rogers Towers.
No, the dog will be answering it soon. The other thing about markets is that they operate on the basis of that we're rational choice, you know, that humans act rationally. Hmm. So the market's all predicated on the basis that we make a rational choice. But as we know, a lot of our choices are kind of highly irrational or idiosyncratic.
Well, in my case, just idiotic.
Idiotic, yeah, absolutely. You know, they're not made with any kind of... And as you say, we like to cherry pick the evidence that we happen to suit our mood or suit our kind of prejudgments. So... you know, this notion of rationality, which is a lot of libertarians, I mean, particularly radical libertarians, you read a philosopher like Robert Nozick, you know, it's based on the notion that actually human beings, if liberated, can be entirely rational and make rational decisions which will ultimately benefit everyone. But I'm sorry, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've remembered Graham's reason. I think it was that markets work well when there's a simple objective. Wasn't that it? You know, that if companies are competing and it's something like producing the cheapest widget, then the competition becomes very effective in solving the technical and structural problems and overcoming the challenges. But when it's very complex and they don't have simple targets to go for, then they're not so good at solving the problems of complexity. Or they might be, but no one knows whether they have or not because they tend not to be measurable anyway because you don't know whether you're looking at the right measures.
That's right.
So it doesn't drive them in any particular direction. So there is that. I suppose in conclusion though, Steve, I remain sort of as apolitical in this as I can. As an educator, I think probably I could live with a few of them as experiments. I wouldn't like to see the system go wholesale towards it, but you know, if you're going to have all these academies and free schools, I don't have a problem with one or two of them trying it out to see if they can make it work. And if we can look back in 10 years and say they did, well, fine, doesn't bother me.
No, it bothers me. It bothers me greatly.
Yeah, just on principle. It
bothers me greatly. Yeah, and I just think the consequences of that argument, I mean, the whole thing unravels. You know, once you get a kind of foot in the door, then it changes the whole value system of education. You know, it's just a consumer. It becomes even more. It is now, and to a certain extent, becomes even more of a consumer good.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm neutral. I'm not particularly pro it. You know, I'm not saying I'm pushing for it, but I'm neutral on it. I suppose I would put the counter argument there that at the moment then we've kept these values of public service, but what we've got is a system that the Sutton Trust told us didn't turn around the job, didn't turn around performance expectations for you know, for children that were predicted to underachieve in 4,200 English secondary schools.
No, well,
so public values are not necessarily working for us. So, you know, I'm warm about letting anyone who thinks they can crack this tough problem have a go.
Yeah, but a lot of that, you've got to remember, is structural. It's not the fault of schools. I mean, a lot of that is and the research is quite, I wouldn't say conclusive, but it's very powerful. You know, that a lot of it is down to structural inequalities, to poverty.
Yeah,
you
know, I agree with that. But
and class and schools are working against the odds. You know, I mean, teachers are working their, you know, fingers to the bone.
Socks off is the phrase you were looking for there.
Yeah.
I agree with that. But isn't there an argument that the system as it is has proven itself incapable, though, of dismantling those dodgy structures?
Yeah, but it wasn't designed to, in some ways, to do that. The problem has got to be tackled politically on a much wider scale. You know, the fact that you can't expect a single institution in our society to combat all that structural inequality on its own.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to come alongside a whole raft of other...
Let me just go a wee bit deeper on that one, though. You're right, there's structural societal inequality. But, you know, when you look at what we know about teachers... I'm going to quote again that research from ICEP that, you know, motivates me so much, although it's getting a bit old now. We know that teachers themselves have got baked-in inequality. Very many of them, even the hard-working amongst them, believe that some children are just a bit thick.
Yeah.
So yeah. They're the people who are waving the flag very often for this, you know, this pure non-market solid system, but yet they themselves have, you know, are propagating the inequality, either tacitly or actively.
But if you're in a market system, then those teachers would just migrate, wouldn't they, to the schools that could afford to pay them more.
Well, I'll go back to my condition on this, though. It's, I don't want it to be a whole system. What I'm saying is if a couple of schools have a crack, suppose one of their strong measures that they're going to be paid or rewarded on is that they crack inequality and that they hire teachers who have a culture. You remember the Elmore research that said, you know, that said that the, you know, the more adults in the system that believe that they make a difference, the more the results go up. You know, if those are the measures of it, I'm not saying it would work. I'm just saying, isn't there a possibility that they would be able to cut through a lot of the traditions and systems to try things and to promote a culture amongst the staff of that happening?
But what would be the point then of what? I mean, I don't understand. What's the point of making money out of education? I mean, who does it benefit? I mean, the other thing as well is coming up in the news is that if you start, you know, before payment by results, then corners are going to be cut. You know, academies are starting to covertly select pupils. They're expelling pupils or sending them home when they don't want them, you know.
Well, there's another thing, though, that I think you could put a counter-argument for, which is that if you build in the measurements for, let's say Tesco's took over a couple of schools and you're going to let them try and run them, you put in the measurements to say that, you know, if we find evidence that you're with gerrymandering, by the kind of phrase there, you know, your intake... then we'll just simply penalise you. We'll put in market penalisation for it. What we want to do is see a measurement of whether you can make a difference on wider measures, not just attainment, and narrowing the gap. And if they don't make it, fine. We've learned something. The thing that the thing that the market people like that would be good at, probably above everything else, is cutting through traditions and just simply saying, do you know what? If the timetable needs to work a different way, we'll make it work a different way. They wouldn't have any of the detritus that we have.
Yeah, but then if you penalise a company, where do they, you know, where do they take that money from? They take it ultimately from, it still come out of the taxpayer funding, wouldn't it? I mean, they'd just be switching funds around. It wouldn't, they'd make sure their bottom line wasn't being hurt. But, you know, if you had a big conglomeration like Tesco's,
I suppose you would threaten to take the contract, or that would be the point. It wouldn't just be a penalisation. It would be, you know, if it happens a couple of times, were put out to tender, and you know.
Yeah, and then what happens is you have to have an army of consultants transferring the contracts. You then have to employ, you know, this would be by a government who's kind of halved the number of civil servants in the department, and has now hasn't got the civil servants to manage all these contracts properly. You know, so all they're doing is one or two key bits of government business. I mean, if you take an illustration of the of this, like at the moment, is with the planning. I was just having a chat to somebody about who's kind of heavily involved in local planning, and saying, you know, this kind of localism and opening up the kind of the planning kind of market is actually costing the local authorities a lot of money, because what's happening is you know, developers are coming along and say, like, we'd like to develop this bit of land, and they haven't got local planning officers to the extent they used to have, so they have to buy in consultants at some huge, you know, but they don't get enough money from central government to pay for the consultancy to do the planning application, so it ends up kind of in a vicious circle, which again just costs the taxpayer money, and the developers are sitting pretty because, you know, they can drive through their a bargain, because actually there's no brakes on them anymore. Yeah. And I think there's a kind of parallel here with what could happen in education. It just ends up costing the taxpayer more money for very little gain.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with that, because I think we've seen time and time again that does happen, you know, with things like public-private finance initiatives. But we've also seen some instances that private finance has solved problems for us. It's not unheard of, is all I'm saying.
No, you're right, and you're absolutely dead right to put the counter-argument. I think it's good to have this sort of dialogue. No, you're absolutely dead right. I think...
Do you think Gove will give me a wee job in his cabinet?
His inner circle. Yeah, Matthew Boyle's your man, Mr. Gove. I think, but even if you were to say to me, well, yeah, actually, it's making, you know, it's doing something different and the results are getting better or the achievement's getting better, do you know, I would still have a nervous sweat over it.
Yeah, I would as well. I absolutely would. I'm fixating really on the short-term thing here of learning about how to make our system better. And in a sense, what I'm looking for in my argument here is not for a takeover of significant numbers of schools by private enterprise, but yet another flower blooming, you know, so that we can learn from that. And eventually, you know, the whole point of letting 1,000 flowers bloom, I suppose, is in the end, you pick the ones that are healthy, that you like, and you cultivate lots of them. You don't continue to let just everything happen. It's not a free-for-all 20 years on in the education system. And I think I would just like, you know, a 5-10-year experiment to be permissible within very, very clearly defined parameters by a Tesco or whatever. I use that entirely randomly. I think I wrote a blog once about that, so it's in my mind. You know, with a view to then stopping and thinking afterwards to say, right, does that need to come back into public... you know, into public management again, or has this been a successful experiment and we can continue to get some kind of value from it? I don't know, but I'd like the learning to be explored. I think that's what I'm driving for.
Right.
So I'm not against Gove on that, but then I don't trust that his agenda is the same as mine here. You know, I mean, mine is genuinely about saying let's learn what's possible, whereas his is probably just an ideological one about the market solving all problems.
Mm.
It might even be worse than that. It might be sinister lobbying in the background.
Yeah. Yeah,
for a cut.
Right,
of course, we do know that Tory MPs would never go for a dishonest cut. Such a thing has never happened, has it? not even for £500 per half day. Would that be £1,000 a day?
Yeah.
Who was that? Was that last week?
It was our MP.
Was it your MP in Nottingham?
Yeah, Newark. Yeah.
Truffshire.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you, I'm living amongst the swivel-eyed loons.
You're in a rotten borough.
Yeah, I am.
As indeed, they used to call it, a rotten borough. Wonderful.
Yeah, the loons are swiveling.
Dear, oh dear. Oh, well, yeah, you're right. Let's press on. Okay, quickly then. Really interesting story that links in with our wonderful guest spot from Louisa a few weeks ago. She was such a good guest. I really liked Louisa. Yeah. She had such a knack of getting into the kind of inside learning style of chatting. You know, she gave us lots of detail, but was very relaxed with us. It was like she'd been an old regular guest with us. I've done it again. If you're listening, Louisa, a long-standing regular guest, not an old one. Anyway, a little piece of work that's been done, which ties in completely with what Louisa was talking about, by Oxford and York Universities. They looked at the phonics test for six-year-olds and checked the efficacy of it. And what they found is that, yes, it is efficacious, to use that lovely word. The tests are effective. They do identify difficulties in using phonics to recognise and read words. It's a 40-word test, I believe, at the moment. Louisa said to us it has a mixture of real words and made-up ones, which she gave us the technical sort of breakdown of. But anyway, the researchers found, yeah, they are effective. But here's the rub. Yes, they're effective, but what they also found is that when they compared it to teachers' own assessment, just using their day-to-day classroom techniques, they were no more effective. Teachers had made just as clear an assessment of the children before the tests. Yeah. So there is a question over whether that has been a bit of a waste of time and money. But you can never underestimate the need of the people that manage education systems to waste time and money on something that's controlling.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a cynical moment there. As all of you know, listeners, I don't have any cynicism, not a cynical bone in my body. So I would like to purge that comment and to apologise unreservedly. Of course, the architects of the system only have the literacy skills of the children at heart. And another little bit about it is that the researchers have criticised the tests on the basis that if the tests tell you that someone is failing, now, these are six-year-olds, mind, you know, that their phonic abilities are suspect. They go on to say there's no guidance for schools resulting from the test, and I love this, there's no specific funding which follows the identification of children failing to reach the standard in their phonic skills.
Right.
So a quote from this report seems to be, ethically, I think it's questionable to offer screening with no prescribed course of action for those who are identified at risk. Now, I have to say, I agree with this thing. It seems to back up what Louisa said, which is the tests don't seem to really be all that essential at that age for the children.
Right.
But I also find this piece of comment from the researchers very, very funny. Are we supposed to imagine that if you've got a six-year-old in your class, Steve, and you've spotted that one of them's underachieving in phonics, that you're supposed to sit back with your arms folded, think, "Whoa, I've only got them in my class." You know, I mean, what am I supposed to do without the extra funding and the guidance about what I'm doing to remediate? Is it just me, or does that seem a bit bizarre? You know, that we would need some sort of a prescribed course.
Yeah, no, that's right. Part of the problem is actually, what is this? What's the purpose of this test? You know, what is it designed for? I mean, if it's a screening test to help teachers sort of say, "Oh, well, yeah, I'll need more intervention there," then it's obviously a complete waste of time in some ways. If they've already got that kind of level of information and knowledge, and obviously we need to trust teachers to professionally sort of deal with it, and they presumably would be dealing with it anyway in their normal course of their practice. But then, if more sinister, if the purpose of this test is actually to start beating schools around the head, or for the kind of government to put in another audit measure, then it doesn't need a screening test either, does it? Because actually, it's sort of saying, "Well, it's your fault, schools. You know, you're not obviously teaching well enough."
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to take Louisa's line in this one, Steve. She said, "Well, it's not doing any great harm, and you know, I don't think it's a big issue, and it probably isn't taking too much of anyone's time. I don't know what it costs, but anyway, it was quite funny." I've just spotted who it was that made that quote about, you know, questionable to offer screening with no prescribed course of action for those identified at risk. It's the wonderfully named Professor Maggie Snowling from Oxford.
Right. Yeah.
That's a straight out of Harry Potter name, isn't it? Professor Maggie Snowling is like an owl name. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Ah, brings back happy memories of discussing the Nut Brown report.
Yeah.
There aren't enough good names in the world. Anyway, your turn. Throw something at us.
My turn. Yeah. Okay. This one is about. Sorry, have you got a drink ready?
Oh, are we? Oh, hang on till I top up my schooner.
Yeah, it's a very quick one because I really don't know the details of this. It's just a sort of, it just seems to be another Mr. Goves, let's throw it out there and see what happens, you know, exam. But you know he had this plan last year to scrap GCSEs or overhaul them, introduce the old kind of a thing for like the old CSE. The
Secondary Certificate of Education.
Yeah, that's right. You know, for those supposedly less intelligent.
How do I know that? Because I'm a Scot. Did they also have a CSE in Scotland?
I don't know.
Strange that I would know that.
Yeah, yeah. But so that kind of go back to a kind of harder O-level style exams. Anyway, he's talking about a new I-level. He's obviously determined to reform this exam, even though we have to question whether it's necessary if young people are staying on till 18 now in compulsory training or education. But he still believes the exams are not tough enough. I think coursework's still going. And then they had that great U-turn, didn't they, on the kind of on the English baccalaureate certificate. Because there was this thing about, well, we're going to replace the GCSEs with the English baccalaureate, and then, well, we're not going to replace it. We'll give them a certificate for getting so many of the GCSEs that make up the baccalaureate. And then he was going to tackle the franchising thing, which we actually agreed with him, didn't we? The kind of, the exam board thing where exam boards are competing.
Yeah.
See, there's an example of the market not working. Ha, yeah. Coming back to that early argument.
Ha, is that what we've reduced to, an inside learning?
Yeah, absolutely.
A pair of the mightiest intellects that ever came out of our two houses, and we're reduced to, ha!
We're in the alley now.
Is this what happened when you get your PhD? You become a barking academic. Ha, 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 boy.
This is alley cat stuff. I've come out of the bin. Come out fighting. Yeah, you see, market and exam board. So exam board says, well, look, you know, take our exam. It's a bit easier than this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. Anyway, it's a very good example of where the market hasn't done anything for us. Absolutely.
So Gove was absolutely right to tackle that one, but he couldn't for various reasons. He actually blamed Europe for that, didn't he, I think?
Well, if the market's failing, a Tory politician has it as rule two, don't they? Blame the market. Yeah. Blame Europe.
Yeah, before UKIP does so. So he's still on about reforming the... So the latest thing is for this I level... again, I can't tell you what's going to be in it, but
they'll never push that through anyway. Your favourite company will sue them for using that name.
No longer my favourite company.
Have you fallen out of love?
Oh, absolutely. Have you seen what they've done with iTunes?
No, what have they done with iTunes?
Well, sorry, folks. This
you do look genuinely outraged here.
Well, I am. I mean, you know, I've your iTunes needs updating. So download the latest version, and it's wiped off the cover flow, which I thought was brilliant. So don't get cover flow. It does all sorts of weird things about categorizing your albums. So like I've got, for example, a David Bowie album on here, and I can't find half the tracks because they've got guests on, so it scatters it all over the... It's done all sorts of rubbish things with it. You know, why? Hmm. And then they keep introducing operating systems, which... You know, means the old ones are no good. I can't use my email on my old laptop because I haven't got the right architecture and the blah, blah, blah. This is the very thing they accused Bill Gates and Windows of doing. They're now busy up to it themselves. Now, I've got no patience with any of these corporations, plus the fact they're not paying their full whack of tax.
Sweep them aside. That's what I say, these companies. Yeah. Let's go and start using open source software.
Absolutely. So... Anyway, sorry, yeah, you started, but you lit the blue touch paper there. I was on the moment. Basically, we got another exam sort of willy won'ty coming up.
And broadly, you know, I'm picking up some negativity from you here, but is there anything good in this I qualification?
I don't know because we don't know the details. I mean, you know, so it's. My point is I think the coursework, I think it's only science is going to retain any coursework. 10% I think allow for practical laboratory skills, But coursework can account for something like a quarter to 60% of marks for GCSEs. And for some people, obviously, coursework is very beneficial. But I think he wants to go back to this O-level, you know, let's all sit in a hall and trawl our memory banks.
Yeah, that's sad. I think I'll only be happy that the education system's moved on when we finally stop the kids sitting in halls. I have to say, I did put that view to some colleagues a few weeks ago, and they did look at me as if I was too long in the sun.
Right.
Dear. Anyway, okay, interesting one to watch there then. So Gove continues to try and reform the system by some route, by hook or crook.
Yep.
Okay, a brief one. Actually, there's a couple of brief ones that are just worth flashing by you. Don't need much comment. Did you spot the one about the paperless library? I don't think it's a first, but it's a good story.
No.
Basically, it's a Bill Hicks BBC magazine article about paperless public libraries switching to digital. And there's one in Texas now. Bexar County, Texas, they reckon they're about to open as the world's first completely paperless public library. They're going to have 100 tablets to loan out. I presume that means for while you're in the building to look at things. But most of it will be done online and virtually, although there is a building and a physical locus to the place with screens and stuff to go and look at digital books and materials. But they're going to have a holding of some 10,000 digital titles that you can loan from the comfort of your homes. Some of the salient details are that it doesn't sell any, it's not a bookstore, it is a publicly owned lending library. It has some issues that it's found difficult to solve. For example, children's books don't seem to attract the same popularity on digital versions. And apparently the publishers are not giving them any good deals. A quote here said it can be up to 5 times as expensive for the library to buy a copy of a digital book on the basis that a library's buying it, you know, and is going to loan it out. But they're basically saying that at the moment they're going to be reaching 1.7 million people, and they've got a remit for community education, so they're going to have digital literacy courses, and they'll be partnering with local schools. And here we have it again. Basically, it's being badged at the iLibrary by this particular journalist. I could go on and pick out lots of other details, but I just wondered what you thought of that.
Well,
is it a library if it's got no books, basically? Yeah, or is it just a website with a building?
We'll have to, yeah. I was just laughing because it just reminded me I was involved in a building in Birmingham, Millennium Point, which had this technology innovation centre. It was a Millennium project, and it was owned by the Queen and Prince Philip. And, I actually got to shake Her Majesty's hand, and his Prince Philip. But he was going around the technology innovation centre had a digital library of thing. So he said to somebody, "What do you mean there's no fucking books?" But apparently they'd taken a sweepstake, and when they're showing him around, they were saying they're gonna had a little tab going on how long it'd be before he swore. So he kind of made this comment, and somebody behind him put his thumbs up and went, "Yeah, get in there."
Could you give us a dilemma now, Steve?
What's that?
Have we got to beep this out so that we can keep our age limit on iTunes?
Oh, does that?
Oh yeah. Oh, you devil! You.
Does that mean you've got to edit?
This is my fault. Just 10 minutes ago, I accused you of becoming a stuffy old academic with your ha-ing, and now it's bowie and effing, trendier than now. The only thing is, I can't tell whether we're going uphill or downhill.
Well, you know,
it
was came out of the mouth of royalty, that, so.
Well, I guess we're quoting royalty then. If only you'd said quotation marks around that one.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a cracker. But broadly,
sorry, yes, this is a
trend, though, isn't it? That's definitely a trend. You know, libraries, you know, despite the love we have for the old, the old dust covers and first editions that with a tear in our loving eye we would dust off as we caress them, nobody's taking them out really in any big numbers anymore.
Yeah, because the other image that always comes to mind when I think of libraries is Fahrenheit 351.
Yes.
The
Bradbury short story.
Yeah, and Francois Truffaut made a film of it, didn't he? Because that's the temperature.
I don't know who made the film. I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah, I think it's Francois Truffaut. Yeah, it's a good film. Because that's the temperature at which books burn, isn't it? Or something. That was the...
Yeah, right enough.
And then people had to walk around memorising books because they were considered to be dangerous. So there was the secret society of people who wandered around just reciting a book that they'd memorised.
Wow.
But, I mean, obviously that, you know, now with the digital technology, you don't have to do all that. But, it's difficult to tell whether I'm just being a kind of old, sloppy, old, nostalgic romantic or whether there's something genuinely different about a book and a digital print. I don't know. I mean, Socrates famously said that the written word would be the end of civilization. You know, I mean, maybe he was right. I mean, maybe that's a kind of 2,500-year experiment going wrong as we speak.
Yeah. Well, I have to say I'm not panicked yet. I don't see the death of the traditional library just yet. But I can see it on the horizon. You can genuinely see, you know, public libraries closing now. So, you know, it's not a 2-year thing, this, is it? But you could see in 15 years that perhaps, don't quote me on this, in 10 when it's happened, you know, that libraries won't exist in the same format and it'll just be local authorities having a website or something that they, you know, that they can loan out digital editions on. And I suppose the publishers will have to get wise to this. I know that they're already doing it, but I don't think they've solved all the problems yet, have they, of how they control that?
No.
You know, yeah, because of standards, you know, lots of you know, people out there in the poorer sections of our society have probably more likely to buy the non-standard book readers, in which case are they more likely to not be able to access standard books? I don't know, to be honest, or whether it's the other way around, you know. But it's interesting because it throws up another quick question, really, which is, are digital books going to be driven by the market to be very inexpensive? You know, because it turns out that we're reading more now, that, you know, there's been some data released just in the last few months on that, hasn't there, that in actual fact they're not killing books, that paper books are staying reasonably steady in sales and shops, but additionally people are buying lots of digital books. So if you follow that logic through, the market could actually reduce the cost of books, in which case, do you ever reach a point when it's actually not worth the while, even for poorer members of society, to borrow books in significant numbers? I mean, I'm sure there will always be some people that will need to, but not in big numbers. It may well be that we're starting to get the 99 pence book as a reality.
No, it's interesting.
Already seen in fact, I've just finished one by a guy, I have to give him a plug. I've just read a crime novel, Tom Caton novel, a Manchester-based one.
Don't know that
one. Not one, you know. The guy who wrote it was Bill Rogers, not to be confused with the Bill Rogers, you know, who did behaviour management writing and training for schools, the Australian. But Bill Rogers, I think, former head teacher, one of the people in the National College of School Leadership. I worked alongside him in the Northern Facilitation Team for the Network Learning Communities Initiative. And I remember him saying, just when he was retiring, I was only with that team for a few months, that he was going to retire and write what he described as the Manchester Rebus. And it was only a few weeks ago I looked in looking for a new book to read and found the website, and he's got about 6 or 7 novels by this of this character, this police DCI, Tom Caton. But anyway, to get to the point, it was a 99 pence novel, and I did buy it for my Kindle, and I thought, yeah, well, maybe it'll be nothing special. Do you know what? A wee page turner, no problem at all with this novel. Interesting, engaging characters, no better or worse than a rebus or anything like that. Wonderful.
It's interesting.
So there's your plug.
And there's life after head teaching.
Well, I've downloaded the second one. It was a heady £2. So,
I mean, the other question is that, I suppose, is the device monopolies on the devices, isn't it? I mean, because at the moment Amazon have a kind of monopoly on the Kindle, don't they? We were looking to, because I know we had some Waterstones vouchers, but we can't use them for their version of. And again, it's whether the market actually starts to monopolize publishers and the readers.
Yeah. Well,
we better go.
I think the big one. Well, yeah, I think we've got a good light-hearted outro story though for from this week. I don't know if you spotted it, but before that, the reader's question there. I think it's your old favourite company, your former favourite company again, that's the most guilty party in this one. At least things like Kindle and all that, they all read EPUB, which is the you know, the sort of standard format, which I guess you could say is universal. But Apple, for example, who are promoting children's use of books in schools, children's use of iPads and tablets in schools, they're pushing very strongly as one of the key parts of their suite, their iBook Author. So iBooks is there, you know, through the iPad or the iPhone book reading service.
Yeah.
But they've got this software that has you, you know, be able to assemble, you know, your work or a children's work into a book, which is nice and motivating. But you would like to think that would go out in a format like EPUB or something, you know, that was universal. But no, it goes out in Apple's iBook format, nothing else.
Oh, right, yeah.
It's really annoying that a company that does such a good job of design and making products is so anti-sharing and anti-competitive, you know, really horrendous. So there's my wee anti-market rant. I would use a word against them now, but one sweary word's as many as I think we're going to get away with today.
Not any more bleeping.
Anyway, silly outro story. Did you spot this week the head teacher from a school down south? I would need to look for it. You know, I didn't rack it up, but the head teacher whose school reproduced the shockingly silly Gangnam Style video.
No.
A head teacher who, I'm just looking it up as we speak now, head teacher who had basically made a deal with his students. He had said that if they made their targets for their, I think it was for Christmas exams, he would dance the Gangnam Style dance. You know the thing by Psy, the internet phenomenon? I'm trying to type and speak at the same time. I bet everyone out there can tell. it happens that it's a specialist media school that he's the head teacher of. He's about to retire as well. This is his last year. So there's a wee element of this being a bit of a swan song. But anyway, in the background, teachers were rehearsing and the media department were basically reproducing the Psy video of Gangnam Style. And it's interesting. I have to say that I enjoyed watching it. This head teacher's clearly game for a laugh. You know, he gets on his dark glasses and he does the silly dances. There is also a downside to it, which is that some bits of the original video are a little tasteless. You know, as many dance videos are, there are little sexual moments in it. Nothing serious, just little hints of it, as dance often has. But you've got teachers, you know, going through these little dance moves, and it does make you wonder that, oh, is that crossing a line, you know? Or is that po-faced and it's actually fine that the teachers are just showing their gut for a laugh and that they're not taking themselves or that too seriously? Very interesting.
All right. So there you go. So that goes along with the Alley Cat and the Slosh then, does it?
Dance theme this week. Dance theme.
Let's dance.
Actually, as a result of it, you've just reminded me there of your Lex Dance. Because he did this video, which is, as I say, very funny, I've been starting to think about my own colleague head teachers in Argyll and Bute. I'm thinking, you know, wherever there's a head and a deputy that are two men, I'm going to go and suggest to them that they go as a reward for the youngsters and reproduce the Bowie, to get your reference earlier, and Jagger dancing in the streets video.
Yeah.
You remember that one?
Yeah, Martha Reeves. Yeah.
So I'll go and try that idea out. I have a suspicion that I'm going to get short shrift.
I was going to say.
Anyway, we can put a link to that video. It's very interesting, and as I say, it does have some issues around it. Steve,
brilliant.
You have been the cuddliest, best, friendliest har that I've ever had a chat with. Superb fun as always.
Well, it was great sharing the alley with you, and we had it was good. Good to have a bit of a ding-dong, bit of a dialogue about an issue, rather than just cozying up to each other.
On that note, since we've managed to self-congratulate utterly, let's leave on that false saccharine and ersatz is the word I was looking for. Hi. Good night, Steve.
Good night.